This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. Drive north on Roosevelt Avenue toward downtown San Antonio, Texas, and you pass Mission Pharmacy, the Mission Drive-In Theater, and Mission Auto Parts. Then you see a patch of green space, and after that, right off the road, a high stone wall stretching in two directions, part of Mission San Jose. Now, this is not an eatery, a dry cleaner, or any other commercial establishment, but a real mission. Because California may be famous for its missions, but Texas and the San Antonio area is also home to several important, if less known, missions. There's Mission San Antonio de Valero, better known as the Alamo, right here in downtown San Antonio, but you probably knew that. To the south, though, there are other missions along the San Antonio River. There are four other Spanish colonial missions, Concepcion, San Jose, San Juan, and Espada, built in the 1700s. As a way to bring Christianity to the nomadic Indian tribes and to teach them to farm and tend livestock. Today, the four missions are a national park, and the churches are all active parishes. The missions are a rare and beautiful look back at frontier Texas, but as you might expect, at nearly 300 years old, they're showing signs of wear. Most of the original frescoes that once covered the walls, they're gone. The elaborately carved facades are crumbling in some places, and the structure's lime and sandstone walls are being damaged by water, and so they are in constant need of repair. This hour, broadcasting from Brooks City Base in San Antonio, Texas, we'll talk about ongoing efforts to restore and preserve San Antonio's historic missions. What does it take to keep the missions from crumbling, and at the same time allow them to function as national parks and active places of worship? What do conservationists need to know about the structure, the soil under them, the weather, and the increasing urbanization to ensure that the missions remain intact? If you'd like to join our discussion, that's what we're going to be talking about this hour. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in our audience here at the Brooks in San Antonio, you can step up to the mic with your question. Let me introduce my guests. Felix Almaraz is a professor of history at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
Carolyn Peterson is a fellow of the American Institute of Architects and vice president, director of historic preservation and director of design at Ford Powell and Carson in San Antonio. Thank you for being with us today.
Hello.
Sissy Jarry is the president of Restoration Associates in San Antonio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And David Vacasey is the facility manager at the San Antonio Missions National Historic Park in San Antonio, Texas. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Felix Almaraz, there are five missions in San Antonio dating back to the 1700s. Tell us a bit of how they got there and why they were built, a little bit of the history of them.
It was Spain's response to the challenge of the frontier to provide security. It was also a humanitarian effort to bring about a conversion of these Native Americans, into the Spanish way of life. San Antonio was considered a crossroads because it was between the Rio Grande and East Texas. The external pressure was coming from East Texas, the imperial wars, that dynastic wars that forced decisions to be made about defense. And the mission, therefore, was one component of this defensive posture.
Mm-hmm. So they were purely religious in nature, but they had practical value, too.
They did. The missions of Texas and those of other frontier areas in the north were not like the European models. The European models did not require buildings. They were simply spiritual activities designed to change the behavioral pattern of the people for whom the mission was being conducted. But out here on the frontier, it had to evolve as a system with ancillary buildings that had specific purposes.
Such as
you have the plaza, for example, would be an open classroom. These natives, these Coahuiltecos, were nomadic. They tended to roam. They responded to their own lifestyles, and they had to have a place where they could be converted. And that was the primary emphasis, conversion, which also included the introduction of a European religion to bring about, to teach them skills in agriculture and in horticulture, in music, in crafts, in irrigation farming. It was a total change.
Hmm. Was there ever any intention to secularize the people?
From the first day that a mission was founded, secularization was always a goal. The mission was only a transitory institution. It did not belong to the church, and it did not belong to the crown. It belonged to the natives for whom the mission was founded.
So take us through the centuries now, coming into the 1800s, what happened to the missions and thereafter?
The change in royal policy was to secularize the missions about 1790s. It was a costly enterprise for the royal crown. The Bourbons, who came to power in 1700, were trying to cut down expenditures. They didn't know what these missions had accomplished, as well as presidios, also military garrisons. And like governments at different times in history, they always try to figure out how to prune the budget. The missions were becoming costly, and they needed to reach that point where they would become then self-sustaining as civic organizations, civic entities.
Mm-hmm. So the missions, they actually lasted through the Congress of the Republic of Texas in 1841 and other places. They were governed by a lot of different people, weren't they?
They were, but it was rather interesting. What happened in the Republic of Texas Congress was really one of those historical ironies, because a congressman by the name of David Kaufman introduced legislation to convey ownership of these mission ruins, churches, to the Catholic Bishop of Texas and his successors, where during the Spanish colonial period, they didn't belong to the crown, didn't belong to the church.
So that set their ownership from then till today?
Well, it created then another problem then for the Bishop of Texas, and how do you maintain these structures? One of them was sold to the city of San Antonio. That was the secularized mission of San Antonio Valero.
The Alamo,
city of San Antonio, then and now, couldn't afford to maintain parks, and therefore...
I like the way you snuck that in, then and now. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Technology changes, but human nature remains the same. And the city of San Antonio then conveyed ownership to the state of Texas. The state then authorized the Daughters of the Republic of Texas to maintain it. But it doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the state of Texas.
But they're maintained. What is the National Park Service then? Where does that come into the picture for this, for the missions?
Well, San Antonio Missions National Historical Park was created in 1978. Through legislation signed by President Jimmy Carter. It took about 5 years to sort out the agreements between Archdiocese, Department of the Interior, in order to manage those areas as a national historical park.
Mm. So, but then you're in a position where you have the federal government managing something with religious value to it, right? Is that a little fine line that we're walking on here?
Well, again, it took 5 years, I think, to sort that out on paper, and still today... presents some interesting challenges in managing the park as one unit.
Carolyn Peterson, the four mission churches are still active parishes, aren't they?
That's right.
So they have services every day?
Yes, and weekly, and they've become quite... I think being active parishes gives them a living attribute that is beneficial to them, too, as historic sites. The missions have had a spotted history from the time that the Catholic Church got them back from the Republic of Texas to the present day. When we look at the missions, we think they've always been the way they are. But if you go back in history and look at even just the photographs that we have from the 19th century, you can see that only Mission Concepcion is in its essential form that it was originally. All the other missions have lost their roof, including San Jose, and had to have been reconstructed. So it just sort of points out the need for an ongoing, long-term kind of approach to stabilizing and preserving them.
So if you go visit the missions today, how much of the original... You know, people want to say, I want to see that original mission. Any of it left? How much of it, David, is it left of the original stuff?
Well, as Carolyn mentioned, at Mission Concepcion, the church structure itself is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, unrestored stone church in the United States. But there would have been a pretty substantial structural compound around that site, maybe as large as 5 acres. So quite a bit of structure that's no longer there now considered archaeological resources at that location. Same is true at the other locations, Mission San Jose, Mission San Juan, and Mission Espada. The exception being Mission San Jose was reconstructed in the 1930s to give us a better understanding, appreciation for what a real mission would have looked like in addition to just the church structure.
Mm-hmm. Sissy Jerry, when you go visit missions or cathedrals around the world, you always taken aback by the murals and paintings and things that are in some of these. And I understand that there are frescoes in some of these missions that are invaluable and need to be protected too.
Yeah, there are. And these missions are considered the largest cluster of missions in the United States and probably the best example of Spanish colonial architecture. It's very fine examples of stone carving and also fresco work.
How are the frescoes done? What parts do they cover and what are they sunk into? If I might crudely put it that way.
Well, the procedure was traditional. They would build their stone walls and then cover them with a finer plaster, and then several layers of a whitewash, which was the ground for the painting, for the lime, tinted lime washes. At the Alamo, one of the red color that we found in the sacristy consisted of vermilion, which had to have been imported from Spain. At the other missions, the fresco work that we have found are made from mineral pigments that they could find locally, from different colors of sands and the red sandstone that's so plentiful at the Bear and Atascosa County line. You see kind of a red sandstone and I think that's probably where they got some of their pigments, and besides hematite, which they did find around Mission Concepcion.
Anything surprising that was found in the restoration of these?
The vermilion.
Yeah.
Everybody, until we found the vermilion, we really thought it was always hematite or an iron oxide or of some sort. Mm-hmm. So it was quite surprising. In Mexico City, the Franciscans had started a craft school in the middle 15th century, and they trained people there to do stone carving, wood carving, architecture, and wall frescoes. And then they secularized the school, and different people managed it for a while. And the only thing we haven't been able to determine if any of these trained artisans came this far north to do the fresco work, because some of it is very sophisticated and some of it is more primitively done. Mm-hmm. But the basics are the traditional tinted lime washes.
And what do they depict? What kind of?
Well, at Mission Concepcion, the baptistry contains some murals that are figurative with the retablo, which is an altar painted on the east wall above a little altar. And then above the baptismal font is a crucifix with the body of Christ on it. And then across the church sanctuary is the confessional, and that is sort of a puzzling pattern. It's very geometric. It looks like maybe rosary beads that go up the wall and follow the barrel ceiling, and then there's a very geometric pattern on the ceiling. But they're still there. It's still the original pigments. And in the sacristy of that same church, Concepcion, behind some wooden cabinetry, is a mural that has never been restored that we know of. We haven't been up close to examine it on scaffolding, but it's still there.
All right, we're going to talk about getting to that mural one of these days. So stay with us. We'll take a short break and come back and talk about the missions of Texas outside of San Antonio. Stay with us. We're in San Antonio. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the restoration of San Antonio's missions with my guests, Professor Felix Almaraz Professor of History at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Carolyn Peterson, Vice President, Director of Historic Preservation and Director of Design at Ford Powell Carson in San Antonio. Sissy Jarry, President of Restoration Associates in San Antonio. And David Vecasey, Facilities Manager at San Antonio Missions National Historic Park in San Antonio, Texas. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You're welcome to step up to the microphones here and talk to us about what's on your mind about the missions. Carolyn Peterson, your architecture firm recently completed a study, correct?
Yes.
For the Catholic Church on the state and restoration needs of the missions. What's the crying need of these missions?
Well, the overall crying need is a long-term approach to stabilizing the missions. Monsignor Janacek and I have been working on keeping the missions watertight for over 30 years, and as having worked with them on an intimate basis for this period of time, we have a real sense of how they are a constant kind of maintenance, constant. They need a constant care, even though they're formidable in their mass. They have complex roof forms that you have to really keep on top of in terms of keeping water out. They have a lot of other problems, such as rising damp, which is a condition where moisture is absorbed from the soil. You can dig a trench next to the wall of a mission and it'll be perfectly dry, but just the moisture in the soil tends to wick up into these limestone walls and be drawn out by the warmth of the sun as it hits the walls and evaporate. And then this process of the moisture going up through, salts are deposited, which actually, as you all remember, spilling salt on a shiny surface on a humid day and come back and there are little drops of water. The deposits of salt make the walls able to hold water more, and so the moisture sort of rises up in the wall until it reaches a sort of balance with gravity. But this capillarity draws the salts out and deposits a lot of them on the surface, and this is very damaging long-term. So that's one of the long-term issues that we're hoping to address. We're also...
Let me just stop you there, because what do you do about that? Do you just constantly scrape off the salt and go back to patching, or can you suck the water out of it, or what do you do?
There are all kinds of ways to do it, and there are all kinds of limitations of what you can and can't do depending on just the importance of a building. And these buildings are so important, we want to be very careful about what we can do. But there are physical and chemical damp courses that can be inserted. There are also drainage issues that can be addressed around the perimeter of the building, like at the granary at San, not the granary, but the sacristy at San Jose has 3 or 4 feet of moist of wall of stone up, I mean, to soil up against the stone walls, which makes it worse. So there's a lot of things that can be done to mitigate it and eventually solve the problem. Mm-hmm. There are also some structural issues. Some of the missions are placed on very expansive soils, and there are constant soil movement problems to deal with. And when Sissy was talking about the frescoes, Mission Concepcion actually still has some of its original plaster with some of its original colorants on the exterior of the building that certainly needs to be conserved. And the carved facades of the missions are original Spanish colonial artworks that are exposed to the weather every day and need immediate and long-term conservation.
David, what about other buildings? Are there any good news about these buildings holding up? They're on their own, or?
Well, the good news is that there are methods and mechanisms that we can put in place to help arrest some of those things, as Carolyn was saying. And really, it's a matter of having the expertise in the field to be able to do the continual maintenance, repointing with appropriate mortars, so that the moisture has a more suitable path to exit those buildings. Also, drainage issues. We're currently doing quite a bit of work in terms of trying to correct some old drainage problems. Each site, each building, each wall has its own set of peculiarities in terms of where the moisture is coming from and how to arrest it. So it's quite complicated in terms of dealing with that. But we have done the best we can in assessing, determining where our shortfalls are, and then trying to put ourselves in place to attain the kind of funding that we need to do the work that we'd like to be able to do in preservation.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the Microphone right here in the audience. Yes, sir.
Yes. You know, with obviously the challenge that lays ahead of us in terms of saving and preserving these buildings, it harkens back to the notion that 300 years ago, nomadic Indian tribes, somehow without the benefit of heavy lifting equipment or other advanced construction techniques, have built these structures that have existed through the test of time and are here today as the challenge and the opportunity for our community. And I guess my question to the panel is this: what was the genius behind the construction of these buildings that still allows them to exist and be a part of our community today?
Are they massive blocks? Or are they? I mean, we talked about that the original buildings are really not there anymore, but they found
the... A lot of the building, I mean, the walls are the walls of all the missions except Espada, the facade is the original mm-hmm. part of Espada. The rest has been reconstructed, at least of the church. They were very massive, and I think that had a lot to do with it. Sissy Jerry touched on the training schools in Mexico. There were masons. They've pretty much established that masons were brought up from central Mexico to help plan mm-hmm. these churches and teach people how to build them and do them correctly. So the long tradition of masonry construction was used here, and mm-hmm. and a great, you know, a lot of the original construction remains, but the roofs, part of the walls, things like that have fallen down.
David DeCasey?
Yes, these I'd like to mention that these massive structures that we're talking about, in some cases like at Mission San Jose, you've got over 6 acres worth of area covered by structures.
Give us an idea of the size of the missions for people who have not seen it. You say these massive structures.
Yeah. There's a walled compound that completely encircles the mission church, at least at Mission San Jose, and that was mm-hmm. kind of the generic idea of how a mission should be laid out for protection purposes. So you have a very large church structure, of course, as the focal point, if you will, of that area, with the walls that might be 2 to 3 feet or maybe even more in some areas thick. And then these walls that also provided the housing situation for the Mission Indians. So you've got a double-walled structure all the way around. In our cases, you know, we've got about 250,000 square feet of historic masonry to maintain. And the point I wanted to bring up about the question was that I think there was a luxury of time and labor in the days of the Mission Indians and the Mission period. If you look at the way the buildings were constructed, they weren't put together in just a matter of a couple of years. It took decades to attain that type and size of structure and compound, and there was constant maintenance. If you went back in time today in 1778, you would see masons throughout different areas repairing, rebuilding, repointing, doing the things that we've talked about here, and I think that's the point, is that the missions need that kind of continual attention in order to maintain those walled structures.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones, to Catherine in San Francisco. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I'm really glad to be listening to this show. I grew up in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I'm learning a lot about my missions today. I grew up in Corpus Christi, and my mother and daddy and I used to go up to San Antonio on the weekends. And I just wanted to speak briefly to the importance of the missions in Texas culture. They were the most meaningful way that I learned about history, about the introduction of the Spanish culture on the native people, about Catholicism. I was a, you know, little Anglo-Protestant, and that was my most meaningful exposure to Catholicism, and also to history and legend. There's the beautiful legend around Rosa's Window at Mission San Jose. And all of those things are very important to me personally, but I think I wanted to mention them because it speaks to the importance of maintaining and preserving the missions as an educational tool, mm-hmm. if nothing else. Also, just briefly, on December 26, 1999, the mission was closed because of something going on with Congress, and lots of parks were closed at the time. I don't remember the details. And I was there at Mission San Jose with my fiancé, and I very much wanted to share it with him. It was a very important part of my background, and I wanted to share it with him. And he's a Jewish guy from Detroit, and, you know, didn't know very much about missions or Catholicism. And I was devastated to find that the front door was closed. And then I remembered, hey, this is a church. It's got to be open. And I went around to the side, and my family and I entered through the church entrance. But it was, and I did offer up an Episcopal prayer, so I wouldn't have entered under false pretenses. But that was a very important instance of that balance between it being a church structure and a church institution and a religious institution and a government one. But anyway, I'm very grateful for the existence of the missions.
All right.
Thanks for having the show on.
Thank you very much. Let me get a comment from Professor Almaraz.
Yes, the lady raised an interesting point about the mission churches belonging to everyone. In 1976, during the bicentennial, there were some of us here who decided that we wanted to do something to focus on the missions, and so the theme of our colloquium was called the San Antonio Missions, a Heritage for All Americans. And it was those conferences that resulted in a published document, including commentaries by the residents of the missions, that persuaded some members of Congress who didn't know the area to realize that there was widespread community support, and that opened up the pathways to the legislation and its approval that created the San Antonio Missions National Historical Park. So the missions belong to Americans.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the microphone, this lady over here. Yes.
I'm writing a book about family history and smallpox, and I'm very interested in the missions because in the late 1700s and early 1800s, the Alamo in particular served as a smallpox hospital for the surrounding area. Very recently, as part of my research, I visited several of the missions, as well as Rancho de las Cabras, which was the farm out in Floresville that supported the needs, the agricultural needs of the inhabitants of the missions. And in my visits to these missions, I found that Mission San Jose had a very good 20-minute film, and Robert Espinoza, who is with the National Park Service out at Espada, he's one of the most knowledgeable curators or tour guides I've experienced in quite some time. But I felt that we are expending huge efforts to preserve the hulls of these places, and that in itself is important, I grant. But the missions themselves has such rich narrative. And my husband and I have traveled extensively in the United States and visited many national historic sites. Will there be any efforts on the part of our local community if we are to develop these missions as vacation destinations in terms of the marketing, to tell more of the story of the mission, to have earphones and listening posts, to actually tell about the lives of the people who inhabited these places more so than what we're doing today?
David Vacasi?
Well, I appreciate the comments you make, and I think that that we do have a lot of those ideas in planning. Our friends group, Los Compadres, certainly has done a lot of work on our behalf in that regard. We have developed a substantial volunteer program, volunteer docent program, funded largely by our friends group. We have a relatively large interpretive staff, although it's not nearly what we require to be able to do all the things that we have in planning. Many of those things you mentioned are in place just in terms of trying to get to the point where we can really implement on a much larger scale. We receive school groups and provide curriculum-based programming for students across Texas and other areas that come on field trips. And as I mentioned, we are continuing to do as much as we can in developing a lot of those outreach-type programs.
As a result of traveling, feel that San Antonio could certainly be marketing itself better and doing so much more in this rich heritage.
Okay. Thanks for the comment. Yeah, we're talking about the missions in San Antonio this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let me go to the phones, and we'll come back to the floor and get some more questions. Let's go to Bill in Buffalo. Hi, Buffalo Bill. How are you?
Oh, good. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I'm not getting any sense from the discussion here that there was a sense that what the missions and the Spanish did in the New World wasn't always a good thing, that there was a lack of respect for the spirituality and the lifestyle of the natives that they were trying to convert. I wonder if the missions could, restoration of the missions could include some sense of that.
Professor Almaraz?
You are using a 21st century yardstick to measure something that happened in the 18th century. the conversion was being done by the friars according to their values at their time. Now, earlier than that, you had another crown policy of responding to aggression on the frontier, and that was a policy of fire and sword. The humanitarians then said there's got to be a more practical, peaceful approach. And so the missions, therefore, constituted that response. Now, at the time, that conversion meant the total picture, not just religion. Adoption of other methods of living. Just to be in one place was a conversion. If they were nomadic and they had to be in one place, that's the purpose of the plaza, the teaching, that was the open classroom. And through time, then, as the conversion process unfolded, then some of these native families received then lodging in the quarters that are found around the walls of the mission. And those who were more civic-minded then participated in the political life of the mission, because the purpose was for the mission to be secularized and to leave behind a community. And the community then involved all of those people who were there. And they no longer were to be viewed as natives or to be viewed as mission converts, but rather vecinos, citizens of the empire.
Answer your question, Bill?
Well, I hope a sense of that whole picture could be included in the restoration.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. The woman who was asking the questions, David, about the restoration, you'd have to strike a balance, you know, from turning it into a commercial center where you walk around with those little earphones and you hear, you know, Diorama speaking to you as you walk by them, and keeping the balance as a place that's still a functioning mission.
Sure, right? There's always a delicate balance, and people learn and absorb information and experiences in different ways, and I think the National Park Service tries to do that. Of course, you don't always want to use funding as a reason not to be doing a lot of things, but we certainly do have a lot of shortfalls in our operations. We've just completed doing a business plan for the park, and that helps identify to us what the important areas are of what we do, the important areas of what we should be doing, how we're spending our money, and where the shortfalls are. And I think that, in the long run, is going to help us to be able to be more competitive for funding and for grants, and also for our friends group to be more successful in attaining a lot of those things for us.
Carolyn Peterson.
Yeah, I wanted to add to that the current campaign that is going on to raise money to preserve the missions is really aimed at preserving the missions elements that are used for religious purposes, because as there was not a separation of church and state during the Spanish colonial period, Spain actually paid for the missions and sent soldiers.
I have to interrupt that. We'll come back because the clock is the tyrant here. I'm sorry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the restoration of San Antonio's missions here in San Antonio. And when I rudely interrupted Carolyn Peterson, she was trying to make a point, and I'll let her finish her point if she'd like. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I was just getting around to saying that currently when the national park set up and the mission national parks were set up, the Archdiocese of San Antonio, because of a ruling by the Attorney General for the separation of church and state, had to keep the responsibility of keeping the mission churches and any other buildings used for those purpose for religious purposes, and that's been a big burden. And we've gone to public and private entities to get funding for it. And there's a current campaign to establish a long-term fund to keep this continuing much-needed preservation work going over the next 10 to 15 years.
Was my point. Felix, summarize, you wanted to...
Yes, I'd like to follow up. In 1983, when the cooperative agreements were signed, it was made very clear that there would be a separation of church and state, and they even used an example that if you take the wall of the churches, there would be this imaginary membrane that would be between, and then everything outside then would be the responsibility of National Park Service in a crisis. but everything inside then was responsibility of the Archdiocese of San Antonio. The general public doesn't realize this. They believe that if Los Pastores, or rather Los Compadres, not the Pastores is that cultural arts group, Los Compadres raise, they raise funds to, they're like the support group of National Park Service, but the general public confuses that and say, well, if they're raising funds, why don't they take care of the mission, the churches? This is why this organization, this initiative called Las Misiones was launched, to raise funds to take care of the church, the mission church buildings, and to preserve and to restore them. Because the church does not receive funds from the public for this particular project.
So David Vicasey, as someone who worked for the Park Service and has the burden of keeping them in top shape if you can, but you can't cross the line. I mean, how do you deal with these? You know, where do you stop? Where do you say, hey, wait, this is out of my jurisdiction. I can put an electrical outlet in here, but I can't fix the wall or something like that.
Well, in terms of the agreement with separation of church and state, as Dr. Almaraz mentioned, it really does stop right with the church buildings. It can get very complicated because there are structures attached to those church structures that we are responsible to maintain. Of course, there are archaeological resources that are beneath the churches. Any foundation-type repairs that are required for those church structures are going to require some archaeology. Mm-hmm. So there does need to be some cooperation in terms of trying to make all those things happen in the appropriate ways.
Mm-hmm.
On a different plane, if you will, our interpretive staff and interpretive rangers are really challenged with trying to communicate that message to the public. In years past, I can remember in terms of trying to demonstrate that separation of church and state, the rangers not going into the churches at all, just as a demonstration to the public and to educate that this is an area that is maintained and administered by the church. All activities are revolved around church activities. And mm-hmm. So over time, some of those gray areas have gotten clearer. Maybe some of them have gotten even more gray. But it's a real challenge for our interpretive staff to try to help educate the public in that regard.
Let me go to a question. This gentleman's been waiting.
Yes, I understand that the first European settlers to San Antonio were actually from the islands of the Canaries, which is off the coast of Africa, part of Spain. I wanted to know what their influence was in kind of establishing the missions here in San Antonio. And additionally, I have also heard that there are man-made holes, caverns, I don't know what you might call them, underneath the missions. And I wondered what their purpose might be and if they actually exist.
Well, I'd like to comment,
Dr. Alvarez, go ahead.
On the Canary Islands contribution. They came in 1731. Their arrival here was coincided with the transfer of three missions, Concepcion, San Juan Capistrano, and Espada, to the area. And the settlers came for the purpose of establishing a municipal government. With so many human beings in one area and the resources being limited, there were only two resources that mattered, water and land. And soon another resource became obvious or manifest, and that was labor. And some people have this idea that how can I prove that or demonstrate that I'm important unless I have people working for me or under me? Some of the Canary Island settlers, in constructing their homes, felt that they should hire some of the mission Indians who already had acquired skills in the building trades to come and work for them. The church took a different view because they were missions and they were not parishes. They were missions, and therefore, under the law, they had to be treated differently. Therefore, they were not going to allow the friars were not going to allow the converts to become laborers in another institution. And off and on, it was a love-hate relationship across the years, as the human drama unfolded.
Mm-hmm. Do we know? Have these missions all been excavated archaeologically in modern sense, where we go in and try to find the artifacts and whatever, where we might, if we dug them up today, buried under a mound for the first time, we'd find out everything we could about them? Carolyn?
Well, there has not been nearly as much archaeological investigation as you would imagine. The first most comprehensive investigation was done at Mission San Juan Capistrano in the 60s. And they looked for a tunnel then, and the only thing they found was a latrine that had been backfilled. But so, as far as I know, there is no tunnel anywhere in any of the missions. The general philosophy, and there have been digs accomplished in other places, for instance, to do the outline of Mission Concepcion, and but most archaeologists don't want to go in and just do a wholesale dig because they want to preserve what's underground for future generations that may have more sophisticated techniques for analyzing materials that could be lost in our current way of digging.
But they do it all over the world in different places, you know, Greece, Middle East, all kinds of places like that. When they restore them, or they don't have the same fear that they're going to lose that kind of thing?
Well, a lot of times an archaeological excavation is done in response to either a threat to the resource or something that's going to happen. If it's under the ground and it's taken care of, and then I think the attitude is to leave it alone.
So there's nothing to be learned by finding old pottery sherds, things
oh,
like
yes.
that. You would. So it that's what I'm asking.
Well,
those, David?
I would say, as Carolyn mentioned, doing archaeological investigations for the purpose of finding archaeological artifacts really doesn't provide a whole lot of value. But when you are using that as an opportunity, when you have other development that's taking place, or more accurately, preservation measures, correcting drainage issues, if you will, doing other preservation to stabilize foundations, those are opportunities to conduct the archaeological investigations, find those important artifacts, put together additional stories, learn more about the history of that particular site, the peoples that were there, mm-hmm. and those kind of things. So, of course, the resources are much more valuable in place, but when they must be disturbed for protection or for essential development, then you use that as an opportunity to conduct the archaeological investigation.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the question here. Please step up to the microphone.
Okay, I've heard a lot of people talking about the restoration and all that other good stuff, but I kind of want to know, I know last year they did some celebrations at San Jose Mission. They celebrated, you know, Fiesta. I took my son, and they had a little carnival there. And what other kinds of things do they do to attract the public, you know? And are they free events that go on, or, you know, do they cost, or, you know, are we expected to pay for them? And does that money that is raised, does that go to the mission and not just the church? Because I don't see a separation of church and the mission. I see that as one, as a citizen, and having the privilege to live across the street from San Jose Mission. I see it as one. I don't see it as a separation. And is anybody going, you know, to try to do something about that? You know, to bring it together, the church and the mission, so that if the church raises money, it can go to the mission as well and not just the church, as far as preservation.
David, do you handle that?
Well,
the U.S. representative?
Yeah, more of a legal question I'm capable of handling in terms of that.
above your pay grade, as they say in Washington. All right, I'm sorry we can't get an answer to that. Let me remind everybody, I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. But it is a hot topic. Let me move on a little bit, because we're running out of time. Sissy Jerry, I know that the frescoes there that you're working on, tell us a little bit about how you try to preserve those frescoes.
When in 1989, the National Park Service put together a team that consisted of Anthony Crosby out of the National Park Service field office in Denver, who was the project architect, and then Paul Schwartzbaum out of New York City and Venice, who had worked on the Sistine Chapel, and two Italian conservators. And they came down, and basically they had experience with buildings of this age and the type of restoration that was required there and conservation treatments. And they instructed the team as to what we should do as far as cleaning the frescoes, reattaching paint flakes the size of a pencil eraser, using different chemicals. We cleaned the salts, as Carolyn Peterson referred to. We cleaned it with ammonium carbonate and then manually with the scalpel where the salts had become sulfate incrustations. Mm-hmm. But that's basically, and then there was a very small amount of image reintegration, which is to go where the paint colors are lost to
tried to figure out what it was.
It wasn't difficult to figure out what it was because the designs are very simple, mm-hmm. But to reintegrate colored pigment in there.
And how do you then protect it? What do you put on it to protect it from?
We used Paraloid B-72, which is
sounds like an airplane. I don't know what that is.
Well, it's an adhesive. Basically, it's an adhesive, and where the plaster, the skin of finished plaster had delaminated from the rubble wall, we used a hydraulic lime mixture that we could inject, and I couldn't even begin to tell you how many gallons we put into the walls at Mission Concepcion in the library. Because we had a wall that was existing with the fresco on it and a space and then the rubble wall. And so it just took a lot of injections, and you do it, well, what we were doing it with was a veterinarian needle and about a 16, I guess it was a size 16, but it's a vet needle. Hmm. Holds about 1 or 2 milligrams, and so, you know, that takes a lot.
One needle at a time. Wow, that's pretty cool.
And then the reintegration of the image or the colored, we had very tiny brushes, and you do it either with a vertical, very narrow vertical line or a dot. So it took a lot of people in there and a lot of time. It's very tedious work, but it's worth it because what we have here in San Antonio and in our decorative paintings and all the missions is representative of what was going on in Europe at the time. Well, everybody knows the Sistine Chapel and when it was painted in the middle 1500s. And so the techniques and the procedures and the fashion of decorating the walls and the ceilings of churches and palaces was very common in Europe. And they brought it to Mexico, and then it came north to San Antonio.
And you've got them stored there.
Yes,
okay,
we're
all going to go out and take a look at these frescoes and the other missions. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank all of my guests, Carolyn Peterson, Vice President, Director of Historic Preservation, Director of Design at Ford Powell Carson in San Antonio, Professor Felix Almaraz, who is Professor of History at UT San Antonio, Sissy Jarrett, President of Restoration Associates in San Antonio, and David Vicasi, Facility Manager at the San Antonio Missions National Historical Park in San Antonio, Texas. Thank you all for joining us, taking time to talk to us today. Our audio engineers in San Antonio are Kevin Wade and Marty Curcius, Cal Southworth, Vince Muse, and Suzanne Mesnick in Washington, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kimoleski and Alphonse Vinn, and also from Justine Cannon and Evie Stone in Washington, and of course Greg Smith composed our theme music. Please, if you'd like to know more about the missions and get links for them and learn more about them, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We can send you over to the right places. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Curricula made for teachers and students to learn about. There'll certainly be stuff on the missions there. Also, you can take away the programs on Real Audio and listen to them on your audible.com player. And we'll have to say goodbye from San Antonio. Thank everybody for helping us out this week. And remind you that we'll be back in New York next week. And I'm Ira Flato in San Antonio. Mm-hmm.